alcoholic. I think it's a great pleasure that they asked me to introduce the speaker. I've been trying to figure that out all day. I've been doing a lot of research on him since yesterday. And usually I can find something to say about somebody when I get up here, because usually you introduce the speaker with some background. And I really tried on this. I took him to Mount Rushmore today, and while I was trying to find out something about him so I could tell you tonight, he fell asleep. And I guess that will tell you that I should get out of the tour guide business. And just in case he has that same thing happen this evening, I was kind enough to bring him some bookmarkers for the big book in case that would happen. I did find out, though, by listening this evening that he has an interesting past, as much as I could find out about it. He said he got in trouble with sheep, or he worked with sheep, it was something like that. He got in the insurance business, and of course that everybody knows that would probably be his downfall. I think he's in the law business today, and it does give me great pleasure to introduce Frank from Denver, Colorado.
My name's Frank. I'm an alcoholic. We're getting to be kind of a rare breed in AA. You got to look to find alkies now. The first thing that I want to do is thank you folks. For your hospitality. You have fed us well, you've treated us kindly, and furnished us with a lovely room, and we are very grateful for that. Now, Roger's introduction wasn't too kind. I got off on the wrong foot with Roger. He and Bud met me in the airplane, and Roger's got a car a block and a half long. Got a lot of gold on him. I said, boy, you must have had to steal a lot of stuff to get that. Well, he took offense to that. But he confirmed my worst fears when he said he sold insurance. Now, Bud, on the other hand, I can't badmouth him too much, because he had the good taste enough to invite me to speak here. But he's pretty compulsive. He called me, 6 months ago or so to speak at this thing. And then a day later, he sends me a letter and asks for my itinerary. I think he's a little bit on the compulsive side. I'm not a circuit speaker. I rarely speak at these conferences, and I have not over the years. But the reason that I'm speaking is that I hate alcoholism. I hate the suffering of it. I hate the deaths of it. I hate the souls that it steals. And I committed years ago, when I committed to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to make every effort that I could in respect to alcoholism. There's a myth in AA that people get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That simply is not true. Most people that come in Alcoholics Anonymous do not get sober. One fellow at York Street that sat there for years figures it's 6%. I figure it's a little higher, but not much. Most people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous do not do the work. And they go back to drinking, and they die. But I have a promise in this book that says that I can get and stay sober the rest of my life if I'm willing to submit and to do certain simple things, precisely spelled out in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last reason that I'm talking is for the sake and for the love of God. Now, Roger said that I was to speak 1 hour. He said that if I spoke 5 minutes longer, he would not give me my present and my cup. He said if I spoke longer than that, I could walk to the airport. Now, in all fairness, to those of not like mind, here's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to spend a little more time on my story and my drunkalogue than I normally do, because there is a new feeling, a new movement in AA, that you don't have to drink to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that you can have other funny aberrations is sufficient for qualification for membership. I have a book that says Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. And that's the position that I'm going to talk about tonight. Now, that may be offensive to a few of you. Then I'm going to talk about how I do the steps and how I did them the first time through. And I'm going to tell you how I do them on a regular basis. And that's how I stay alive. And how I have recovered from the disease of alcoholism. I have recovered from the disease of alcoholism. Now, I have a book that says it shows precisely how the first 100 people recovered from alcoholism. It is popular in certain quarters to say, I'm recovering. Now, you may know immediately that those that say they are not. They are telling you this program does not work. They are telling you that they are less than they are, and they are not responsible for their lives. That anything that happens to them is because they are recovering. And they have no responsibility. But I have recovered. Now, I have temper tantrums upon occasion. Rare indeed, as my wife will attest. But that is not because of alcoholism. It's because this phenomenon of the recreation of the ego. And it's not because I have not recovered. Now, I do not mean that I have been cured. And that does not give me permission to rest on my laurels. And that if I do, that I will deteriorate and I'll move back to that state of consciousness and I'll be drunk again. Now, you'll notice that I brought my own drink. I still have that full hand syndrome. I tell you, you can tell the alkies from the winettes and the pseudo-alkies and these other people by how they hold a glass. Have you ever noticed? There's a young fella bouncing back. Here he is over there, that kid with the big blonde hair over there. Couldn't sit down last night running back and forth. Now, if he's an alkie, he's what we call the baby robin type alkie. Yeah. All mouth and no brains. Now, I'm not setting him up as an object of ridicule. The tragedy is that an airhead like that and his ilk die so goddamn quick. I think the only great mistake they made in this big book is categorizing one set by they stopped in time. I've watched more kids like that die than any class. They never drink long enough to learn their trade. Drinking takes a high degree of skill. You got to be very efficient in the things of the world because you haven't got much time to deal with them because you got to drink. You got to know, have a great deal of stamina to suffer through the things that are the everyday life of the alcoholic. You got to have a pretty cunning twist of mind. Now, you do not develop these skills overnight. You got to be on the street and in the bars and around the bottles to get the moves so you don't get killed. Now, that poor boy, you watch him flop around here. Now, he ain't going to last very long on the street. He's going to get in here, get all kinds of warm fuzzies, and start drinking again, and bang, he's dead. Now, we've had a couple of these in our group in the immediate past. One was a young fella named Harry, and he came in and he started doing the work, but he was too young. And he had the illusion of all youth that he was immortal. And got drunk. And got to feeling very sorry for himself because he had no rescuers. And he took a pistol and put it in his mouth and blew his brains out. Now, another one of our members is in the apartment complex across from the way. And she notices old Harry sitting in the window. She can't notice his brains are gone, but she sees him over there. One day, 2 days. About the third day, she's not too heavy either, but about the third day, she notices he hasn't moved and goes over there to see what's wrong with Harry. And the stink of the apartment and that poor boy with his brains across the room was why it's not all right to be an airhead in AA. See, this has been a wonderful time. But if you're an alky, first, are you going to live? Are you going to survive? Most don't. Are you going to survive? And then second, are you going to make the connections with God and live this incredible, glorious life that this big book promises? I sobered up March 12th, 1966 at York Street. When I came into York Street, I was not a popular pigeon. People did not cluster around me to help me. I got my sobriety date was given to me by another man, because I had no recollection at all of how I came to York Street. I do not know and do not know to this day if I was sober when I came to York Street. I was given my sobriety date by a man that said that I was there on March 12th and I'd been sober since. I remember I was some old fool at a meeting was saying, if you don't remember your last drink, you haven't had it. God, I don't remember the last months of drinking, so I guess I'm in pretty deep trouble. Drinking to me, you know, some people sit out and they can lay out just a nice little drink log. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, you know. Mine's kind of like a pool of pus. And you just reach in, and all the night I'll reach in that pool and pull out a few stories so you can see whether or not I identify or not. My physical condition was incredible. I had, and I still do, I have chronic cirrhosis. But it was very much aggravated at that time. I was blacked out. I had not eaten in many months. I was suffering from malnutrition. Every time I lay down, during the first weeks of sobriety, I'd break out in the hives. First, I couldn't sleep at all. Then I slept about 15 minutes at a time. I had the DTs. it took me a while for me to understand what the DTs were. I never saw snakes or bugs. But I'd walk down the street. I had DTs wet. I not only had them, generally you get DTs when you get sober, but I'd have them wet sometimes. I'd walk down the street and a voice would say, Frank McKibben. Now, do we turn around or don't we? Is there somebody really there or is it there? Or I'd sit in this pool of color and I'd pull out people's heads and watch them spin with great awe. They weren't bad. These were not frightening. The voices were terrifying. I was in trouble. I practiced law as a profession. I remember one conference, they had a lawyer there, and he was lamenting that he didn't have any clients. I had clients. I had a lot of barmaids and bellhops and taxi cab drivers and a lot of good clients. But my difficulty is that I could not remember a great deal of them, of ever having seen them before. And they'd come in the office and we'd play, this is after I sobered up, who are you? And have I seen you before? And did I take any of your money? How much? What did I promise I would do for you? I was in trouble with the courts. I had behaved contemptuously in the name of righteous indignation for the defense of my people. And I was not popular in the courts, and I had been very neglectful at a great deal of matters that needed and deserved my attention. I had people, now you'll have to pardon my expression, who were after my ass physically, who wanted to see me dead and with just cause. Then I had a family. I had a woman who was almost destroyed mentally. And by the way, Mary Pearl, she did not give me any shit. Oh, you and I would have made a pair. I remember there was a meeting when I was fairly new, and I was saying, well, at least I never touched my wife. And then on the way home, we played Oh, By the Way. I say, not only did I not touch her, but on more than one occasion, but on one occasion in particularly, I punched her out in her nightgown, drug her out into the car, and decided that we'd take these two kids that we had so they wouldn't have to live with such despicable people any longer. And I'd drive that car into a cement abutment and kill us all. Incidentally, I had tried suicide two or three times. And I got the car cranked up, and the unfortunate woman came to and pulled the keys out of the car and ruined the whole little melodrama. I had a four-year-old child, her name is Linda, who I could not and I cannot remember one day of the first 4 years of her life. The last thing that I can remember was her mother in labor, and I was drunk in front of the TV set, and I said she would wait till I saw the end of Gunsmoke. Then I took her to the hospital with her legs crossed. I don't know what happened at the hospital. All that I remember about that circumstance was the doctor held me in contempt. I was a sweetheart. I missed little things like Christmas, Easter, and what have you. I was a daily drunk. My idea of heaven was the back bar in the Albany Hotel in Denver. They tore it down after I quit drinking so it would never be used for a lesser purpose. The back bar of that hotel, they opened around noon after the lunch hour. Everybody hear me? After the lunch hour, and they closed at 7 o'clock at night. That's an unusual bar, isn't it? Well, they served 5 ounces of gin or 5 ounces of Manhattan. Manhattan was made one part sweet vermouth and four parts pepper whiskey with a dash of vermouth, or 5 ounces of rum. Your choice, 80 cents. People moved into that hotel to drink in that back bar. The youngest barmaid was probably 72. There was no piano. There was no mirror. There was no music. And they kicked you out at 7 and let whatever was going to happen happen someplace else. Now, that's a person who knows how to run a bar. Now, there were many promises. Never again, honey, this was the end of it. Today's the day I quit. And before dark, I'd be back in the bar. I had taken the law school cure for alcoholism. I went through law school drunk. I gave this pitch one time, and a woman cussed and gushed, and she says, "Oh, Frank," she says, "how did you get through law school?" I told her I was a drunk. I was not stupid. The worst day of my life when I got that degree. Frank McKibben, J.D., right? Juris Doctor. I am an educated man. I had gone to law school to find the inside knowledge of what was wrong with me. I had my friends around me. They'd come over from the Western Slope. I'd ran sheep. It's wool grower to you, Flatlander. Anything I hate is a milk-fed kid. Let me tell you about this trip to Rushmore and me going to sleep, right? First he told me that he had designed Rushmore, but he was such a child, some adult had taken and stolen the idea from him and taken the credit away from him. Then we went up there, see? Now what is it, 20-some miles up there? It took him 7.5 minutes to get there, right? He beat that time coming back. And my eyes were closed all right, but I sure as hell wasn't asleep. Anyway. One of your people gave me this little piece of literature. 15 points for an alcoholic to consider when confronted with the urge to take a drink. A little do-it-yourself manual for how to stay sober. Now you got everything in here from mind control to love thy neighbor, and everything except the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of your fellowship gave it to me. I know you just keep it for toilet paper. And there's no mention in here about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you can keep yourself sober with mind control, do it. If you can keep yourself sober with nice thoughts, do it. For God's sake, do it. If you can keep yourself sober with any of these 15 points, thank God you don't have to be in this fellowship and go and drink normally. But if you can't do that, and that crap is not working for you, let's talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is how I worked those steps and how I worked them when I came in. I was extremely fortunate when I came in to have fallen in with a step worker. At that time, they were rare as a hen's teeth. There was all sorts of things going on. Do it any way you want. Do it when you can. How you do the program is suggested, etc. Worship doorknobs. Don't say God at a meeting. You might scare out the new man. Incidentally, I wanted to mention J.D. He'll feel awful bad. He thought I forgot him here, didn't he? Well, J.D. is an interesting fella. Now, he has done the work, and through the 12 steps and regular work on the 12 steps, he has recovered. But that's all internal. He looks the day like the day he walked in. And what we had to do when he was about 4, 5, 6 years sober was tell him to quit telling the new man, if you want what we have. He was scaring off more drunks. I was presented with these steps. I was told there was one book, and that was this book. And those steps were read to me. And I was left alone with it. And I was told, decide whether or not this is what you want to do. I didn't misunderstand that. Incidentally, I was an atheist, which I consider a great advantage, because I was forced to choose all the way down the line. Some of my friends were believers, and they had to be brought to the position where they knew they didn't believe before they could get along with the program. And I did not have that encumbrance. The first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. This is how I do that. Am I an alcoholic? This is how I do it today. Now, it's been quite a while since I've had a drink. Now, maybe I was a situational drinker. God knows I had a lot of situations in my life to drink about. Now, those situations have long, long ago disappeared. Now I can drink normally. I do not answer these questions. I let my body. A is about experience, not theory, not knowledge. Now, I was an emotional mess. I could have been diagnosed as anything. I am emotionally stable today. I am by anybody's standards. And I am in a profession, and I am a trial attorney, and that is tested on a regular basis. Now that I am emotionally stable, I can drink normally. What about 2 drinks a day for 30 days, no more, no less, and don't skip a day? Can I do that? Am I like you? Am I like you? Now, one drunk can smell another drunk, that's the truth. Am I a real alcoholic? The big book talks about real alcoholics. And distinguishes them from the heavy drinker. God knows I was a heavy drinker. I was a hog drinker. I didn't have a problem with my drinking until the end of it. A lot of other people had a problem with my drinking. Lots, because I was a coward and I was a bully. I'd play big chicken game in a bar. And you'd find some slick Romeo with his girlfriend. And I'd let him know what a coward I was. Push him with his girlfriend. Me out. Then on the way out, I'd let him know what a terrible mistake he'd made before I hurt him. Till one night, there's a boy, and I can see this boy in my mind now. He got on his knees in front of me, had dark black hair, and he begged me, it's remarkable that I remember him, and he begged me not to hit him. And one thing about drinking like I did, you got to stay, you can't get aware. Awareness kind of screws things up, you see. And this big flood of awareness hit me. And my God, and what have I become? I have become everything I despise. I'm a coward and I'm a bully. That was the beginning of the loss of my soul. I gave it away in the DeNargo market. With low life. Been bullying me all day. Can I manage my life without God? The first step is without God. Of myself. Can I manage this talk here? Can I know what to say to you? Can I know who needs to hear what I have to say, if anything? Can I manage to be effective here, now? Can I manage my emotional condition? Can I keep myself free of fear? Can I keep myself free of depression? And then I remember this morning, a little girl came up to me tonight, I'm wringing right with sweat, and she says, are you not nervous? And I said, no. Can I manage my personal relations? That's my darling sitting there. Now that first wife and I made a valiant effort to put it together when I was 8 years sober. Our worlds were too far apart. And I married this drunk girl here. Can I manage this relationship with this? Because she's the prettiest girl in AA, still is. I watch some of these young pretty ones. They don't know what real beauty is till they see this girl. Look at her blush. Oh, I haven't seen that happen. Okay. But I do love her. And I've been given the capacity to love through the grace of God in this program because I didn't give a shit about you, me, or anybody else in this world. I couldn't. I didn't give a damn about anybody. I didn't when I come in, and it wasn't until I'd been through these steps that it began to happen to me. And I didn't weep. And I've wept. I wept on my first birthday. Surprised the hell out of me. Stood up at the podium and just cried like a baby. Ruined my image. Lost 5 clients out of AA that day. Can I manage to be happy with her, to love her, to care for her? Of myself or that guy? Can I manage to work for the clients I work for? To work effectively with integrity, to not rip them off, to give them my worth? Can I manage to work in front of some of these half-assed crazy nuts we call judges in Colorado? God, don't let that get back. No, we have some fine judges. Some of them may wear too good, but can I manage that? Can I manage money? I'm in debt. We've had hard times in Denver. Can I keep from waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and worrying about money? Another dumb and trifle thing. Can I handle money effectively? And then I experienced this, and all this examination from the viewpoint of the first step creates a tension here. Creates a friction. And this friction is the friction that I'll carry through the 12 steps. Then I draw my worth to the second step. Now, the second and the third steps that I took when I first came in were bitter, bitter, awful things. I was sick. I had some hope. You gave me hope. Not much. You also told me that I could choose to believe. He said, Frank, look at some of the idiocy you do believe. You chose that I could choose to believe in God. So I sat alone one dirty, damn long night. And God, if there is a God, and if you'll have anything to do with the likes of me, all right, that's the best I could do. That was the first time I took the second and third step. The way that I take them now, incidentally, I go through these steps at least once a year, including writing an inventory. Why? Because that's what the book says to do. If it ain't in the big book, it ain't. Anything that I say you cannot reconcile with this book, I'm wrong. That was tough for me. Because I'm a big league free thinker, right? And I'm going to submit to living my life on terms other than my own. That's the decision. And that's my decision now. And sometimes now, it is not such an easy decision. Because that old free thinker still lies within me. I approach the second step. Do I believe, or am I willing to believe, that past here is a whole state of consciousness, of wonder, of grace, and of love, which I have not experienced, of wisdom, effectiveness, that I know nothing about? Or is this all there is? And in that book, in the chapter to the agnostics, which I damn near ignored, because I was an atheist. Found out what an atheist was. He isn't a fella that doesn't believe in God. He's a fella that just doesn't believe God has any relationship to him or is relevant to him. So am I willing to believe that God, with this tension, with the real awareness of where I'm limited, will he do for me what I cannot do for myself? Now, God is either all or he's nothing. If this is all there is, he is not all. He is limited. So he's not God. Either tis or taint. And then the book says, who in the hell are you to say he isn't? Yes, he is. And that's the second step. Now we move to the third step. The first condition of the third step is that any life based on self-will cannot succeed. That is the first requirement of the third step. I must be convinced of that. Well, what is self-will? Self-will is what I believe to be true. It's my truth. It's the best of me. See, I have a fine experience. My old ego comes up and says, that's right, Frank. Yes, sir, that's the way it is. And what was experience turns into truth and knowledge. And it's my knowledge that kills me. This belief that I, with this 2.5 whiskey-soaked mind, can package and understand all. An infinite God, the mystery of God, and that I know. And I know how the hog ate the cabbage. Am I convinced any life based on self-will cannot succeed? Now, the greatest hope in AA is found in the third step. It says, all of my troubles are of my own making. That's a statement of hope. It does not say that I'm some kind of a victim. It does not say that I have a low self-esteem or that I am a codependent or that I was set on the pot backwards when I was a child or that I'm the child of an alcoholic. It says, Mister, your troubles are of your own making. They arise out of yourself. Quit looking for saviors. You're the guy. Alcoholics Anonymous puts the ball where the hell it belongs. Those that accept it lose their value to a whole industry. When they accept the fact their troubles arise out of themselves. Why do I say? Because it goes on to say that in the last analysis, it is within yourself that you will find God. It is within yourself. And that is true. And I have found it so. And March the 12th, I was sober 25 years. When the year before I came in here, I had not been sober 5 days. And I am healthy and I am whole because in the last analysis within myself, I found the grace and the love of God who freed me from it. Then you move to some more decision. Am I willing to be an agent of God? That's pretty presumptuous. Hell, I'm here tonight. I'm speaking for God. God tells me to tell you these things, right? That's what the book says. It says you're going to stand in the shoes of God. You are an agent of God. Then it says, He is the master and you're the servant. You remember old Charlton Heston, an El Cid movie, you know? He's riding around on the horse and he's got shields and spears and everything, you know? That was my image, right? I didn't notice that little fella scuttling around waiting for him, you know, hoisting and fetching, you know? Now, am I willing to get off that horse and start fetching and carrying? And be a loyal servant of God. Talks about being a child of God. He is the Father and I am the Son. Now am I willing to accept the grace and the bounty of God? Undeserved and unearned. The gifts of a father to his child. The providence, the care, and his protection. So I'd much rather have earned it or deserved it out of my goodness or my good works. But I have to go to God with my hands on my, with jam on my face. Am I willing to say, yes, God, I accept your mercy. I accept your forgiveness. I accept this beautiful green jacket. And then the fourth step. Took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. This is how I do that. In the first column, you put down the name of the son of a bitch. Or bitch, as the case may be. Take his inventory, or her inventory. And then in the third column, it shows you six things that it affects. My self-esteem, my ambitions, my personal relations, my sex relations, my security, or my pocketbook. And through each one of these offenses, I get a picture of my ego. It says, being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us. we consider it its common manifestation. Resentment is the number one offender. So you start with your anger, and you, the devil must show his tail. And you take it to that third column, and you find out you're ruled by a committee. Using this process, I found out that I was not a prince that had been kidnapped from the king and queen and raised by these two peasants. I have found out again and again that I am not God, nor his anointed Christ, nor even one of his disciples. I found out that I'm not Mr. AA. I've had to find that one out a lot of times. And I found a lot of other things out. I found out that I'm not a perfect husband. I found out a lot of things using this simple system. Then the fifth step. And I take this inventory. I prefer to take fifth steps with drunks. Why? Because priests, preachers, psychologists, etc. are too damned easy to con. I go to a drunk who has done the work, take it to an understanding friend, and they're much, much harder to fox. And say, Frank, didn't you forget, or did you see, and we have a nice long discussion. And then the sixth step, the sixth and the seventh step. On the sixth, I review the work I've done and be sure it's solid. And on the seventh, I must come to God with a real awareness of my limitations. See, I'd love to approach God with clean hands and say, here I am, your loving child, see? But I come with dirty hands and a dirty face. And in that seventh step prayer, ooh, I missed a big one. I'm going to go back and recite the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and to build with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I apologize for that. That's a big hole. But on the seventh step, I now say that seventh step prayer. My Creator, I'm now willing that you have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Incidentally, I use that seventh step prayer each evening in my evening meditation when I review my day, looking for selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. Then I make a list of people I'd harmed. I use these 3x5 cards. He poo-pooed my cards. You know, I hate these high-bottom drunks that can remember things. I have to write them down. I take these cards and I go through my inventory. Not only the people that I've written on, but I watch these patterns, these beliefs, these marks of arrogance, these flashes of self-pity. And I look clear through my life and see if they've been operative with other people. And I put those down in the cards, and this is a list. We make a list of all the people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And then I go and face each of these people. God, I hate it. I hate the ninth step. My ego rages. I'm sorry, I won't buy it. Here's what I did to you. Here's how I harmed you. And lay it out, line after line. But incredible things then begin happening, and those promises after the ninth step come banging into your life again. And you again experience a new relationship with God, which you maintain in 10, 11, and 12. I learned how to 12-step from two-steppers. I learned how to pray from Christians and from Taoists and from Buddhists and from AA. Simple prayer. God, you know what a coward I am. God, you know how many times I've crapped out. Here I come again. Give me the courage to go. Or when it's real, real tough, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. God bless Jenny. God bless my dead mom and daddy. God bless my kids. That's a savior, boy. That's a bailout one. And when you really get stuff, I really get down on my knees. That praying's incredible stuff. I'm talking about praying in tough times, but praying in good times. And learn how to pray. Learn how to meditate. If you get your meditation to an hour or better a day, your whole life will change, day in and day out. If you need to, I've taken yoga lessons. I've done all sorts of things. And I do a simple thing, like after I get done with my praying and I do the AA meditations as they're set forth in the big book, then I sit quiet and watch my breathing for 20 minutes at a crack. And I do that in the morning, in the middle of the afternoon, and the evening. And when I can maintain that, my life turns into a glory. Now I'm going to take the last few minutes and I'm going to talk to you about the group and the traditions. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. In our group, we have alcoholics. Now, I have a dual problem. I've got big feet and they hurt a lot. But we don't talk about my big feet or other dual problems. We're not interested in drug talk at all. We have a group conscience. Our group conscience is committed to the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is how we work our group conscience. We have a timekeeper who is the chairman. All he does is find out what the topics are to be. And then we go around the circle. First, the group votes on what it wants to talk about. Once that is determined, we go around the circle and each person talks 1 minute, no longer, on the topic. Why is this important? It's because some long-termer or old-timer cannot dominate the meeting, or somebody who is better educated or more verbal can politic the meeting. And the idea is, that tradition that says the only authority we have in our group is a loving God. And before we have this group conscience, we pray. Incidentally, we have this during meeting time, not 5 minutes after a meeting. And we bet that God will disclose to us what we're supposed to do. We pay careful attention to our minority opinion to check off to make sure we're right. And with this system, our group conscience is that the people in the group, and by the way, all this is suggested, as the big book is, the people in the group will be alcoholic, that we're committed to working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as set forth in the first 164 pages of the big book. We don't trust the stories anymore. Our trustees aren't as trustworthy as they used to be. Anyway, and that we will work those steps. The only topics will come out of those 12 steps. In our home group, no one can share under 5 years sober. We have other meetings for the younger people to learn how to share, because we want quality meetings, and most what happens in our group happens outside the meetings. Now, we have sponsorship. I'll tell you about my sponsor. I asked him to be my sponsor. He agreed, and he's denied it ever since. That's true. Absolutely true. He's the one that trusts me in the steps. He did not say, anytime you need me, call me day or night. He was totally unavailable. I remember one time, and I was in desperate straits, and I finally persuaded him to come see me. And he said, I'll meet you at York Street. So we met at York Street. He said, check out a big book. So I checked out a big book. He says, come with me. We went up on the second floor. He opened the book, and he read the first step, and he says, how are you with that? And I said, oh, God, great, you know. And he read the second step, and he says, how are you with that? And he said, well, I don't know. I don't have much pain. He closed the book. He says, that's where you are, and left. Yeah. He understood who was responsible. He understood who was responsible. A ruthless man, but incredibly effective. That's basically our idea. We get them free of sponsorship as quickly as possible. We get a new man in the steps immediately. And if you're interested, go drink some more or go to one of those other more merciful groups. Let me tell you something. You slip in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares if you drink. If you don't believe me, think about what you think about the slippers in your group. Do you give a damn? Nobody cares if you drink either. It's an awful fact for Alcoholics Anonymous. It is for those that want it. Why don't we care? It's a spiritual principle. I can only care for you if you care. If you don't give a shit, I can't care. I can play care, I can try to care, but if you don't care, it's impossible for me to care. Well, quit tapping your foot, I'm about done. God, oh my. I ain't even got an hour under my belt. Well, I'll quit. Here. Now, if I've said anything that offends you, I cussed a little, I apologize to Al-Anons, not the Alkies. I didn't. But if I've offended you, get a yellow pad out, take a ruler and put three columns on it, put my name in the first column, and my offense in the second. Okay. Don't miss this. Don't miss this. This incredible God, this glory of God. I have had great success since I've been sober, and I've had great failure. I have been terribly sick, and I have been very well. I have been loved, and I have loved. I have friends. And I have AA. And may God bless you all and thank you.